Morning, all. Ross Foundy is a graduate of BYU and University of Washington Law School. He's professionally accomplished, currently a partner with the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine with a practice focusing on IP litigation. He's been voted by his peers one of Washington's super lawyers for 11 years running. He served actively in the LDS Church, including as a bishop for 10 years, and in the truly daunting callings of scoutmaster and seminary teacher. He also feels strongly about community service and has served in various capacities, including as a Parks Board commissioner out on Bainbridge Island. Personally, he is married, has four kids, and six grandkids. Did I get that right? Six? All right, okay. His adult life has been marked by constant activity, both mental and physical. An avid rider, in recent years, he's moved from horses to bicycles. He's ridden in a few races, including ones in Europe, and at least as of this date, he remains one of the few Americans who's not been accused by French doping officials of using performance-enhancing drugs. Several years ago, he relocated his family to a place on Bainbridge Island. He refers to his bountiful farm, where he raises horses, cows, chickens, sheep, geese, peacocks, keeps bees, and maintains a koi pond. When it was pointed out that the lack of agriculture technically makes it more of a ranch than a farm, he acknowledged that, but noted that farm is easier to spell. He was able to convince his wife to come with him to Bountiful on two conditions. One, she never has to milk a cow, and two, she never has to use a chainsaw. How do you do? So far, so good. Excellent. Let's see. Beyond physical activities, Ross has kept his mind active, including being an amateur historian, studying, among other things, the life of the Prophet Joseph. In 2005, Ross took a sabbatical from his law practice and accepted a position as an adjunct professor at Brigham Young University Law School to teach jointly with another professor on the legal history of Joseph Smith. His work included directing law students in writing background research papers on various aspects that eventually are going to be included in the Joseph Smith, the legal section of the Joseph Smith Papers Project. We're privileged today to be able to hear from Brother Foundy and to learn more about the Prophet's legal involvement and the manner in which the over 200 discrete legal proceedings that he was involved with impacted his life and his thoughts. Ross.
There's some great legal research into that introduction, I'll tell you. That's great. A wag observed some time ago that the Catholic Church says the Pope is infallible, but the Catholics don't believe it. The Mormons believe their prophet is fallible, but the Mormons don't believe it. And I think that's sort of a great starting point to the things that I'd like to share with you today. The notion that in spite of some really candid acknowledgments on behalf of Joseph Smith himself, doctrinal pronouncements on multiple occasions, and even revelations that were very public, proclaiming his personal shortcomings, the persistent march of Mormon history for the last 150 years or so has been what could charitably be called the march toward the beatification of Brother Joseph. What has happened, however, recently is a reevaluation of the whole role that Joseph played, not only in the founding of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but also in American history. And so it was my good fortune to study the intersection between Joseph Smith and his legal affairs and the development of law in the United States here a couple of years ago. I learned, I think, as a philosophy 101 student, that we should be wary of watersheds that force us to make one of two decisions. And I think the Prophet Joseph Smith's life illustrates that that conundrum. There are those who either determine that he was a saint and that everything he did must have invariably come from God, and those, on the other hand, who believe he was a charlatan. In the words of Von Brody, a mythmaker of prodigious talent. I learned to avoid those sharp distinctions, and that whenever there's a watershed in which somebody is telling you the rain must fall on either the north or the south side, sometimes you need to be aware that there's a higher watershed. And the notion of a prophet who is fallible is something that the Latter-day Saints wrestle with uniquely, and yet I think others as well are beginning to challenge us and look at that concept. That the notion that an individual could be both subject to a prophetic calling and also fallible at the same time, I think is a very interesting topic. And it may be that someday our times, the times in which we now live, in which there is so much going on with respect to Joseph Smith's history and the interest in his life, things may be dramatically changing. I dare say that at some point in time, people may look back to our time as being a watershed event in terms of the looking at, in terms of the picture of Joseph Smith that emerges. Some of you are old enough to remember What's My Line on television, where people would get up and bluff and comment, and then the final answer was, will the real Joseph Smith please stand up? And depending upon how the buildup was, we were sometimes surprised at what we heard. And for some of us, myself included, the legal affairs of Joseph Smith are the most interesting and perhaps revealing of all. I'm not here to sell books today, but were I would tell you that there's a couple of great books you should look at over here. They are from the Joseph Smith Papers Project, which is really quite remarkable. Two volumes have been published to date. The second volume of Revelations is due later this year, which will be the third in the series. And the latest word is that about 18 months from now, we will be able to see the first volume of Joseph Smith Legal. These will be Joseph Smith's legal papers. They'll go from New York, Ohio, and Missouri to 1838. And there'll be at least a second and perhaps a third volume subsequent. It's quite remarkable, as Troy said in the introduction, the number of times that the law intersected with the life of Joseph Smith. Let me just tell you a little bit about that. Joseph Smith's career really began in 1830 with a couple of events that I'll mention later. He was dead in 1844, so 14 years of his history, during which he was involved in over 14 cases a year. Now that means that he was literally in court once a month or more. I know some lawyers who style themselves trial lawyers that don't have any kind of a record to compare with that. He was frequently a criminal defendant, in which the state was the prosecuting attorney, so to speak. And he was, however, more so a party to the proceedings, either a plaintiff or a defendant in civil cases, or in some cases, a complaining witness in a criminal case. He was also served as judge of the Nauvoo Municipal Court, which was quite interesting in and of itself. It looks like about 25% of the time in which he was involved in civil litigation, he was the plaintiff. That is to say, he invoked the law on his behalf. His earliest appearance, I'll mention in just a minute, was about 6 months before the first vision, which is significant for Latter-day Saints at least. And that was a time in which he really began his career, I think, with great optimism and enthusiasm for the possibilities of the law as a vehicle for truth and justice. And of course, ultimately, the law failed him completely at Carthage. He was in jail, most people don't fully appreciate, under a charge of treason, which is really quite remarkable in American history. Could have only happened in the 1840s, that an individual who is serving as the mayor, elected mayor of a municipality, and who issues an order to destroy a printing press, which grates on our teeth right now, because of course the First Amendment is something that has grown significantly in American history. But in those times, it was not uncommon, literally, for public presses to be abated as a nuisance. In any case, whether you agree with him or not, he was acting under color of law as a member, as an elected member of the city council, and along with the other aldermen who were working, he was twice cleared of those charges, once to be sure before a Mormon justice of the peace, and secondly before Daniel Wells, who was not a Mormon at the time, subsequently joined the church, but having been twice freed from those charges, the notion of double jeopardy was something that was going to develop much later. He was in jail a third time on treason, which is really quite a stretch. The notion of committing treason against the state is something that we can't even begin to comprehend today. I mean, how would you commit treason against the state of Washington? I don't know, cross the Columbia River without a fishing license or something? Normally you think of that as dealing with the Russians or selling secrets to the Israelis or something like that. But nonetheless, treason was not a well-developed concept at that point in time. Daniel Wells again, not a Mormon at the time, subsequently joined the church after Joseph's death, had been a lawyer all his life, came from a legal background, and he was to say that Joseph was the best lawyer he ever met. He said that he had an intuitive understanding of the law and a unique application and understanding of the law's possibilities. And he surrounded himself with lawyers. One of the things we've learned recently is the number of lawyers that Joseph hired in his defense. We think that maybe that was, some people might think that that was because there weren't any Latter-day Saint lawyers around, he was forced to go to Gentile lawyers. Turns out not to be the case. Many of the leading brethren in the church were lawyers. Joseph, however, seems to have regularly sought out non-member lawyers, and he genuinely sought the very best he could find. His journals, he bragged that he had found the finest lawyer in Upper State New York, in Upstate Missouri, for example, in the case of Alexander Donovan, and others. Where we have more time today, it would be fascinating to explore the lawyers who represented Joseph Smith, their impressions, their reactions to him, and what Joseph Smith was like as a client, which is certainly something that, as a lawyer, I'm interested in. But let me just kind of walk you through some of the intersections of Joseph Smith and the law which have fascinated me. Here's a promissory note dated in 1818, signed by Joseph Smith Sr. and Alvin Smith, the prophet's older brother who died sometime later. It's a promissory note for $65. The significance of it, it's payable to Jeremiah Hurlbut. And Jeremiah Hurlbut was a significant citizen in the community of Palmyra. And the Smith family hired themselves out as day laborers to him. What's significant about that is that they dared sue, that is, Joseph Smith Sr. filed a suit against Jeremiah Hurlbut. And here is the what we would call the bill of particulars. We don't really know whose handwriting this is, whether it's Joseph Smith Sr. or perhaps even the judges. But in any case, there's a listing of all the things that they're claiming against Hurlbut. And it's quite remarkable in a number of occasions. Here, for example, is a closer look at it. To myself and hireman team for one day, $3. You get a notion of what a day's labor was worth back in that time. And then you see to making hay $1, so apparently a grown man's labor was worth about $1 a day. And then you see down at the bottom to Joseph, a half day drawing hay 25 cents. This was Joseph Smith Jr. at age 13, working beside his father on the farm. Here is the judge's notes of the proceeding. And he has indicated here, you see the jury is sworn, and it's actually a jury trial, which is quite remarkable at that point in time. And then you see he has the witnesses that are listed. And one of the witnesses you'll see, of course, is Hiram Smith. And below it is Joseph Smith, Jr. So here's young Joseph at 13 years of age, who serves as a witness for his father. Then, as now, a person under the age of majority has to be separately interrogated by the judge, who has to determine that the individual knows the difference between right and wrong and is capable of serving as a witness. You don't have an automatic right to be a witness if you're under the age of majority. So here we know, then and now, Joseph Smith had to be separately examined by a lawyer to determine, by a judge, I'm sorry, to determine that he was knew the difference between right and wrong. And Joseph apparently passed that test, and he's able now to speak for his father in court. The The jury found for the plaintiff, Joseph Smith Sr., and awarded him $40.78 against the defendant. Now again, what do you think this would have meant for the Smith family when they had taken literally one of the community leaders and taken him before court, before the law, and won? I think this would have significantly influenced young Joseph in his views of the prospective opportunities that the law might afford. Here's another one that's quite interesting, and I'm going to tantalize you, I hope, to maybe sell some books here. But here's an example of Chauncey Higbee. This is going late in life, 1842, where Joseph Smith sues Chauncey Higbee. And he sues him because he is slandering and defaming him by saying he's teaching polygamy. Now, this is a very interesting situation. Up until right now, if you wanted to follow this case, you'd have a very, very difficult time. About the only place you're going to find any reference to this is in a book published by Mr. and Mrs. Price called Joseph Smith Fought Polygamy. The Prices are original members of the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They're individuals who broke with the community of Christ and now run what's called the Restoration Bookstore. And at the time, they were the first really to discover, looking in the Carthage records in 1962, this document. They also found an original affidavit or declaration of Joseph Smith, signed by Joseph Smith. And among other things, they found this, which is a subpoena for the witnesses that Joseph intended to call. They would be Alexander McRae, Margaret Nyman, her sister Matilda Nyman, and another woman by the name of Sarah Miller. They also found the witness list for Chauncey Higbee, who incidentally was called before the court and forced to post a bond, which his brother Frank or Francis posted for him. And he listed his witnesses, Nancy Rigdon, Sarah Pratt, Emmeline White, Amanda Gee, and Melissa Schneidler. Wouldn't it have been fascinating to see the trial transcript of that hearing? Unfortunately, it never came to trial. Joseph went into hiding sometime thereafter, and ultimately when the case was called for trial, it was simply dismissed for want of prosecution. But the Prices, who have really were the sleuths to discover this, tell a fascinating story about the pleadings to this case. They discovered the pleadings in 1962. They returned again in 1968 to find that Joseph's signed affidavit was missing. Unfortunately, they had not been able to photograph the original affidavit, but they had made a hand-transcribed copy of it. And then they went back again in 1998, several years later, and this time found the entire file was missing. They were told, and of course they have their own perspective, but they were told that the file had been shipped to Salt Lake, and that from their perspective now, this allowed them to build the whole case. And their case goes like this, is that if Joseph Smith dared to sue somebody publicly for defaming him for teaching polygamy, obviously he was not a polygamist. Obviously he must have, and obviously the Utah Church, which wants to promulgate the notion that Joseph was involved in plural marriage, must have suppressed this. It's very interesting. What happened, in part, we're probably convinced, is that individuals recognized the value of Joseph Smith's signature and it was probably stolen. But in any case, what's significant about this case is that it will appear in the volumes of the Joseph Smith Papers Project, the legal volumes, so it'll be fascinating to see. There are other little tantalizing tidbits that relate to law with respect to the Joseph Smith Papers Project. The second volume of Revelations, which is now being readied for the printer, has an interesting aspect. In 1843, right after Joseph Smith was arrested in Adams County and released on a habeas corpus petition, he described the event to his scribe, Willard Richards. Willard Richards, whose handwriting is normally pretty legible, was obviously writing very hurriedly, trying to keep notes down. And he included a statement, which has since been repeated over and over again, that those involved in the process were a, quote, spiritually minded circuit judge and a few fit men. Some of you are smiling because you know that under the new revised version of that, having taken a closer look at Richard's handwriting, it reads, a spindle-shanked circuit judge and a few fat men. query how the Supreme Court Justice John D. Caton, who is obviously the circuit judge to whom Joseph was referred, who is described by one biography as being rather lanky. One can imagine that he wouldn't have appreciated being called a jurist with skinny bird legs and a coterie of obese hangers-on. But the praise in the earlier version now becomes mocking criticism, which I think is consistent with Joseph's somewhat defiant attitude toward lawyers and the legal process. We've all heard the famous quote happiness is the object and design of our existence will be the end thereof if we pursue the paths that lead to it. And that which is wrong under one circumstance may and often is right under another. Several years ago, as the bishop of the Bainbridge Island Ward, we were fascinated looking around for a motto for our ward. We want to have something unique. And somebody came up with this. They thought this would be a great motto. And we actually used it for a number of years. And I didn't ever tell anybody what I knew about this, which was that its history of this is really rather clouded. It comes ostensibly, well, no, it actually comes from a book that was published by John C. Bennett based on writings, letters that he had written to the Sangamo Journal the 19th of August, 1842. Now, Bennett claimed that he got this letter from Francis Higbee, who was the boyfriend of Nancy Rigdon, who had got it from Willard Richards, to whom it had been dictated by Joseph Smith. And subsequently, in 1855, the letter, in quotes, was copied into the manuscript history of Joseph Smith by a clerk, Thomas Bullock. And it was, looking at it very closely, it's obvious that the grammar, the syntax, the language of it is precisely from Bennett's History of the Saints, an expose of Joseph Smith and Mormonism. B.H. Roberts, who was, of course, responsible for editing the History of the Church, noted that it is, he said, it is not positively known what occasioned the writing of this essay, but that it is very likely written to apply its principles to the conditions created by introducing plural marriage. Now, the significance of this, which will be my theme that I will end on in a few minutes, is that virtually every commentator since this has determined, commentator, Latter-day Saint and non, have considered that this obviously was a letter that Joseph Smith had penned to Nancy Rigdon in probable support of a marriage proposal. It shocks a number of individuals because this was Nancy Rigdon, at the time, was 19 years old. And what's remarkable also is that the church has pretty well accepted this. It reads like Joseph Smith. It sounds like Joseph Smith. But is it Joseph Smith? The letter will not be included in the Joseph Smith Papers Project. Let me repeat that. This letter will not be included in the Joseph Smith Papers Project. The reason for that is fundamental provenance. There is no provenance to suggest this actually came from Joseph Smith. I'll return to that in a minute. Nancy Rigdon, as I indicated a minute ago, would have been a witness in the defamation trial had it taken place in 1842. Nancy Rigdon was also a witness for the prophet in the Liberty Jail hearings. Quite interesting. So Joseph and Nancy had a relationship, a friendship, even a mentoring relationship, or if you please, a romantic relationship preceding that. Nancy Rigdon is a person clouded in history, and it will be remarkable to get the whole story regarding Nancy Rigdon at some point in time. I'd like to make a little bit of a abrupt change here and talk about Joseph Smith, the street brawler. The next references come from the History of the Church, which is a fodder ground for mining, anybody who's so inclined. It's a remarkable history. Remarkable in the first place that so many things were kept and preserved, and that they're collected together by B.H. Roberts as a part of the church history. Most of us who are anxious to see the new Joseph Smith Papers projects probably should start by doing a better study of the history of the church. And here, the next several quotes I'm going to share with you come from all from Volume 5, and I assure you that there are equal references in the earlier volumes as well that we could look at if we had time. But here's Joseph talking, giving a speech upon being freed on a habeas corpus writ in 1842, and he said, "I'll tell you a story." And he goes on to say that a man who whips his wife is a coward. "When I was a boy, I once fought with a man who had whipped his wife. It was a hard contest, but I still remember he had whipped his wife. And this encouraged me, and I whipped him till he said he had enough." The best evidence is that Joseph was at the time just after the first vision, maybe a year after the earlier reference. He was with Porter Rockwell at the time. Porter Rockwell was 12 years of age at that point in time, Joseph 15. And that they were coming around the corner and heard the cries of a woman in distress, found the man beating his wife. Joseph rushed in as a young teenager, grabbed the whip out of the man's hand, and proceeded to pummel him. And as he indicated here, they fought apparently until the man backed off. This begins the history of Joseph Smith, really as a street brawler. I want to read to you another one. This is also from Volume 5. This is December of, sorry, this is Volume 2. December of 1835. This is a letter that Joseph wrote, which is in the history of the church. He writes, he says, "I saw that your indignation was kindled against me, and you made towards me. I was not then yet to be moved, and I thought to pull off my loose coat, lest it should tangle me, and you be left to hurt me, but not with the intention of hurting you. But you were too quick for me, and having once fallen into the hands of a mob and been wounded on my side, and now into the hands of a brother, my side gave away. And after having been rescued from your grasp, I left the house with feelings indescribable. The scenery had changed, and all those expectations that I had cherished, when going to your house, and brotherly kindness, charity, forbearance, and natural affection, that in duty bind us not to make each other offenders for a word, but alas, abuse, anger, malice, hatred, and rage, with a lame side, with marks of violence heaped upon me by a brother, were the reflections of my disappointment. And with these I returned home, not able to sit down or rise up without help, but through the blessing of God I am now better." This is Joseph's letter to his brother William. His brother William, who had pummeled him in 1834 and apparently injured him in 1835. Again, it's remarkable that this appears in the history of the church. Joseph seemed to have been determined that everything touching his life would appear true or false, allegation or proven fact, and that it appear in his history. It's quite interesting. Here's another one. This is kind of walking through history, 1835. Joseph wrote a letter to the Painesville Telegraph demanding that they publish in the paper the fact that he had been cleared in court of a charge of assault and battery against Calvin Stoddard. Calvin Stoddard was his brother-in-law, and they had obviously been involved in a serious altercation as well. It goes on and on. There's another Hurlbut involved with Joseph Smith called Dr. Hurlbut, Dr. Philastrus Hurlbut. It wasn't a doctor, that was just the name that he was given at birth. But Dr. Philastrus Hurlbut apparently was involved in fisticuffs with the Prophet Joseph at the temple, site of the Nauvoo, or the Kirtland Temple. And they both rushed to court about the same time, suing out a writ. Joseph was first, again, because he had the better lawyer, probably. And as a result, Hurlbut was actually put under recognizance bond, sort of we would call it a bond to temporary restraining order that he should stay away from the Prophet Joseph Smith and post a bond. And ultimately, Joseph again was cleared in that proceeding completely. Hurlbut was found to have threatened Joseph Smith's life, to have threatened him with his, that he would actually drink his blood. Maybe I can just interrupt myself a little bit. It's a great story, and as a lawyer, you love it. This takes place in the Painesville church there because it was the largest building in town. The reason for that is because there was such attention being attracted to the Mormon prophet. People wanted to see and hear what this would really be like. So various estimates post the crowd of at least 400. They're crammed into this church facility, and a man by the name of Bissell is cross-examining Joseph. And now remember that the charge here is that Hurlbut has threatened Joseph Smith's life. Okay, so Bissell begins to ask the question, and he says, "So, tell us about the gold plates." Now, any of you who have watched any television, any length at all, you know that that's an opportunity for Joseph's lawyer to stand up and object. That's irrelevant, has nothing to do with the case involved, and that's exactly what Joseph's lawyer did. The judge apparently sustained that objection. And now, this is Bounty's Interpretation 101. Joseph reaches over, puts his hand on his lawyer's knee, and says, "Don't worry about it. Let me answer the question." His lawyer withdraws the question that the judge has already ruled is properly sustained, and Joseph proceeds to tell the story of the angels and the gold plates, etc. One senses, and incidentally, as I say, Joseph won the proceeding. One senses that Joseph was never afraid of a jury, that he looked forward to the opportunity to be able to tell his story to a jury. It was not the juries that troubled him. It was the judges. Most people don't realize, even Latter-day Saints who study the Joseph Smith's revelations received from Liberty Jail, that again, Joseph was being held in Liberty Jail on a charge of treason. That's a remarkable charge. What had happened was there had been a fight at Gallatin in which a couple Mormons and non-Mormons had banged heads and perhaps even used clubs to bang heads with. And the notion was that Joseph Smith, who was miles away, had somehow incited this riot. Well, that's fine. Inciting a riot is one thing, but treason? It just strikes you as absolutely incredible. And nonetheless, we now know that Judge Austin King, really what he was doing, Hiram said this early on and people didn't believe him, but now, and you'll see this more in the Joseph Smith Papers Project, it's very clear. Joseph was being held as a hostage, pure and simple. They knew that if they charged him with a crime like inciting a riot, that was a bailable offense. He would have been freed the next day. He would have been out on bail. But nonetheless, if you charged him with treason, that's a non-bailable capital offense, can't be released until trial. So Joseph is being held in Liberty Jail, and it's very clear he was being held as a hostage. And as soon as all the saints had left Missouri, there was no longer reason to keep him. And they knew that if they brought it to trial, they couldn't win, so he's allowed to escape. And one of the more fun things that appear in the Joseph Smith Papers Project will be the promissory note that Joseph Smith gave to one of the sheriffs who was guarding him, in which he purchased his horse, in which he could escape to Illinois and join the saints. So here's an interesting one, again, in Volume 5. Josiah Butterfield, who had been a regular thorn in Joseph's side on occasions, came to his house and insulted me so outrageously that I kicked him out of the house across the yard and into the street. It doesn't sound just like a polite, would you kindly leave me alone at this point in time. It sounds like, again, some serious fisticuffs were involved. This is one of the more remarkable stories from Joseph's personal history, that a tax collector came in the midst of a conversation he was having with a number of clerks. He told him, "I'd always been ready to pay my taxes when I was called upon. I did not think it gentlemanly treatment to sell any of my lots for taxes." And I told him that he was continually abusing citizens here. Bagby called me a liar and picked up a stone to throw at me, which so enraged me that I followed him a few steps and struck him two or three times. At this point in time, non-Mormon Justice of the Peace Daniel Wells stepped between us and succeeded in separating us. I told the Esquire to assess the fine for the assault, and I was willing to pay for it. He refused to do so, apparently. So Joseph rode down to Alderman Whitney and stated the circumstances, and he imposed the fine. Joseph wanted it clear that he had broken the law and that he should pay the fine. And then he returned to the political meeting where apparently Bagby stood beside and muttered continuing frustrations. This also appears in Volume 5. The court was in session. This is the court Joseph is now presiding as a Nauvoo municipal judge. And he said he saw two boys fighting in the street over near Mills Tavern. He said, "I left the business of the court, ran over immediately, caught one of the boys who had begun the fight with clubs, and then the other, and after giving him proper instruction, I gave the bystanders a lecture for not interfering in such cases, told them to quell all disturbances in the street at the first onset. I returned to the court and told them that nobody was allowed to fight in Nauvoo but myself." Now, I don't know about you, but I just find it amazing that things like this, enemies of the church don't have to look very far to try to find a fodder to make an argument that we've got a very fallible prophet who has a keen temper and is not above using his fists to make his point. Joseph understood the law early on, and at a point in time in which the copyright laws of the United States were being developed, Joseph actually applied for a copyright on the Book of Mormon, which is quite interesting. Here is the 1829. The significance of this is June of 1829, and Joseph is actually applying for a copyright. This, incidentally, original Book of Mormon with the Joseph Smith's inscription here, was found just a couple of years ago in the Library of Congress. Apparently it's very difficult to find things there. It's a vast library, and this had been lost for all intents and purposes to the world until it was located. And that was consistent with the requirement that you had to put a copy of the book that you were seeking copyright protection for, you had to deposit that. And so this apparently is exactly that that notion. Harold Bloom, in a very fascinating book called The American Religions, American Religion Singular, well worth reading. Harold Bloom is a Yale, was a Yale, he calls himself a Gnostic Jew, has written an incredible book of studying the American religion, and he talks really about homegrown religions. His most significant attention, I think, is probably to the Latter-day Saints. But his striking analysis of Joseph Smith is a real stunner. Mormons grab it very quickly because he says some things like Joseph Smith is an authentic American prophet. He said there's never been anybody like him, and there will never be anybody like him again. He regards it as a really sad fact of life that only the Mormons, up to that point in time, had really studied Joseph Smith's life. He calls him the most understudied person of unparalleled significance in the history of America. He goes on and on, and he has a couple of criticisms, however, that Latter-day Saints like to skip over some of his criticisms. One of his criticisms that we tend to skip over is he said, Joseph was an indifferent writer. Not exactly a compliment, I suppose, to be an indifferent writer. He also said that he was only an average speaker, which I think is quite interesting. A couple of years ago, Sharon and I were back in Springville, Illinois, and of course there's the wonderful old Capitol building that's been restored there, those of you who have seen it. And you can go into Judge Pope's courtroom, which was where things took place with respect to Joseph Smith and Stephen A. Douglas and Abraham Lincoln and others. You can see it restored there. You can go also into the Hall of Representatives Hall. It's a very wonderful, I think, Paula, you were there with us when we were there. It's a wonderful facility. You walk in there and somebody has placed a top hat, I'm not sure it was actually Abraham Lincoln's top hat, but right in the seat that Lincoln probably occupied when he was in the House of Representatives. In 1842, when Joseph went back there to stand trial before Alexander Pope on this writ of habeas corpus, the Missourians were trying to get him back to Missouri where they could try him. Back in those days, again, freedom of religion and the separation of church and state wasn't anywhere near as well developed as it is today. So the Mormons were offered the opportunity, how'd you like to preach in the House of Representatives Hall on a Sunday? And which they eagerly accepted. It's interesting though, here's the whole town, the whole state, really the whole nation in a sense, interested and eager to see what's gonna happen with this Mormon prophet and the trial. And an opportunity, it's said that most of the representatives appeared there for that appearance. We don't know, there's no evidence to suggest that Lincoln, there's no evidence to confirm that Lincoln was there, but again, some hints and whispers and suggestions that his wife had been so intrigued that we know that Lincoln's wife actually attended one of the proceedings. We know that, but we don't actually know that Lincoln was there. But in any case, it was a wonderful opportunity, you would think, for the prophet to get up and address. He was there in attendance. He sat there carefully, listened as John Taylor and Orson Hyde, spoke. He appointed one of them to speak in the morning session. They again resumed in the afternoon session after lunch. And I think it was Taylor spoke in the morning and Hyde in the afternoon. Joseph did speak. Another fascinating story, of course, is Liberty Jail. Joseph hires the finest lawyer of his day, Doniphan, and his partners to represent him. And on the other hand, Sidney Rigdon appears pro se. He doesn't hire a lawyer, he speaks for himself. Sidney Rigdon was, by all accounts, an eloquent speaker. He was also a bit of a showman. And he was brought into the hearing on a cot, and he delivered his argument from the cot, kind of leaned himself up on one arm. And the story may have improved in the telling a bit, but in any case, Donovan did say, and this is true, Donovan said that he had never heard anything so elegant in his life. He said he melted the assembly to tears. And he said not only did they subsequently release Sidney Rigdon, maybe because of his health situation, but he said they also took up a collection and gave him a suit of clothes before he left town. And now, so Sidney didn't spend the winter of 1839 in Liberty Jail. Joseph did. Joseph did because his lawyer was not apparently anywhere near as eloquent as Sidney Rigdon has been. So it may be that there's more to what Bloom suggests than we've been willing to know. That Joseph was not that powerful a speaker. He was not a Sidney Rigdon. He certainly was not a Jonathan Edwards or an Elmer Gantry or anybody of that ilk. It appears to be that what attracted people to Joseph wasn't how he said it as much as what his message was. An indifferent writer. Harold Bloom makes the argument that some of us disagree with, but nonetheless it bears scrutiny. He says that Joseph really abandoned the Book of Mormon later in life. He says that the Book of Mormon was the product of an unproven bravura mind, and that as Joseph matured, he grew away from the simplistic approach the Book of Mormon had taken and went to the Pearl of Great Price and other revelations that Bloom says are just absolutely astonishing. The record is somewhat incomplete. It was in 1841 that Joseph gave the famous quote that Latter-day Saints have heard a lot. I told the brethren the Book of Mormon was the most correct of any book on earth, and that a man would get nearer to God by abiding by its precepts than by any other book. Still, there are scant references to the Book of Mormon in Joseph's reported sermons. There are seldom references to Book of Mormon stories, verses, or quotations. Part of that, I think, is explainable by virtue of the fact that the Book of Mormon was not yet in chapter and verse. It's very difficult. Those of us who have read the original edition of the Book of Mormon, which, incidentally, I'm not here to sell that book either, but it's a fascinating read. If you're having trouble reading the Book of Mormon, try reading it in the original edition before the chapters and verses begin to intrude on your eyesight when it breaks it up very significantly. And you get a flavor for reading what Parley P. Pratt must have felt, or the feelings he must have felt as he read for the first time, where he said it was absolutely fascinating. It reads more like a story. It reads more like a constant flow. Your eyes are not interrupted. But in any case, it makes it difficult to quote in general conference page such and such of the Book of Mormon. The chapter and verses obviously help in that regard. So, but it's also true that you study some of the early journals of some of the early missionaries, and again, it's not what the Book of Mormon contains as much as it is that the Book of Mormon is evidence for Joseph's prophetic calling. The Book of Mormon is evidence of modern revelation. And so it may very well be that the more important aspect of this is the significance the Book of Mormon had for individuals rather than its scriptural content as the foundation of the Restoration. Let me illustrate that and make another point about Joseph Smith being an indifferent writer. He was a very self-conscious writer. He repeatedly said things like, he wrote to Moses Nickerson in 1833, he said, "I have thought that a few lines from me, though there may be a lack of fluency in address according to the literati of the age, may be received with a degree of satisfaction on your part, this kind of flowery language of the day." What's significant about that, of course, is that letter is in the handwriting of Oliver Cowdery. It's not in Joseph Smith's handwriting. He complained in a letter to Emma, which he did write, it's a holographic letter, that he wrote and signed himself. He said, "O Lord God, deliver us in thy due time from the little narrow prison, almost as it were, total darkness of paper, pen, and ink, and a crooked, broken, scattered, and imperfect language." He was frustrated that he couldn't express his ideas better. And here's part of the reason, I think. Latter-day Saints like to excuse Joseph's grammar by saying, well, you know, the fundamentals of spelling hadn't really been all that decided upon during Joseph's life. Here is 1842, so just 2 years before Joseph's death, near the end of his career. They're printing the Book of Mormon for a second time here, and he's inscribing in his own handwriting that Ebenezer Robinson is entitled to use of the stereotype plate. Stereotype, I could misspell that one myself. Okay, and copyright, I could misspell that myself. Copyright. For the printing of 1,500 books of Mormon, misspelled. M-O-R-M-A-N, as loud as can be. You would have thought that Joseph Smith, after his now 12 years of experience or more with the Book of Mormon, would know how to spell Mormon. And yet, here he is. He doesn't get it quite right. I would like to leave with two thoughts. One is that One of the things that is very intriguing, and Richard Bushman makes this point very significantly in his Rough Stone Rolling, is that Joseph's, the Book of Mormon, springs full bloom all at once. That one would have expected with any writer of any significance at all that you'd have earlier drafts or versions or something to indicate the growth of the writer. And with Joseph, you don't. I like to ask people, quick, what is the first piece of paper that we have that has Joseph's name on it? What do you would guess would be the first piece of paper, when I say his name on it, that isn't quite right, the first piece of paper that Joseph has signed? You know, would it be a letter to his wife? Would it be perhaps buying a piece of property? No, it's not. The first letter is October the 22nd, 1829. Remember I showed you a minute ago the copyright application was applied for in June. So this is a letter that Joseph Smith wrote from Harmony, Pennsylvania to Oliver Cowdery in Palmyra. And this is because Joseph had left Oliver in charge of printing the Book of Mormon. And so he's giving them instructions about the Book of Mormon. So I don't know what you make of this. I make a lot of it. The fact that really the Book of Mormon is our first indication of Joseph's writing. And his wife took great pains, his mother took great pains, and others took great pains to indicate that Joseph was reading the Book of Mormon at the same time he was translating the Book of Mormon. So his first experience with the Book of Mormon was as he transcribed it. Yes, back to my first point, which is the watershed concept. Sometimes we need to ask ourselves, what perceptions or preconditions or assumptions do we bring to Joseph Smith? Harold Bloom challenges us to think about that. He says, I cannot begin to comprehend where this comes from. Because with his background and training, he can't get over the notion of revelation. I think it's also interesting that people don't disclose their bias, and we're very slow to do that. Some of you read Krakauer's marvelous book, The Banner of Heaven. He's a wonderful writer, and Into Thin Air and others like that. You have to read the whole book, however, in which those of us who are grew up in the church, you know, have no concept of what's going on. I mean, we can't even begin to relate to that book. The notion of child murder, the notion of just sordid events that take place over and over again in families and in this book. Having lived my life in the church, I can't even begin to understand what they're talking about. It reads to me like a foreign language, etc. You have to read all the way through the book and read the afterword in which Krakauer tells you what his perspective is, which is to say, A, he doesn't believe in God. B, he doesn't believe in organized religion. C, he starts with the assumption that anybody who purports to speak as Joseph Smith did must be a charlatan, must be a fraud. Let me give you a final example of why Joseph Smith can benefit from a good lawyer or two. I mentioned John C. Bennett's 1842 letter to from Joseph Smith to Nancy Rigdon. First of all, there is no physical evidence of that letter other than John C. Bennett's claim that he had a letter. The letter is not, it's not a letter in any traditional sense at all. It reads, as B.H. Roberts says, more like an essay. It very likely is indeed addressing plural marriage in a very general sense, but there's nothing personal about it, nothing to tie it to Nancy or even to a marriage proposal. Thirdly, the participants aren't talking. Nancy went out of her way not to talk about the event, and indeed in the only recorded interview in which she did talk about it, she distanced herself from any notion. She'd never heard about plural marriage at all, didn't understand it at all, didn't understand that Joseph had practiced plural marriage, but did say, however, that he had changed somewhat the last couple of years of his life. Joseph never spoke about it either. So rather than having Joseph or Nancy or even Marinda Hyde, who was apparently part of the, according to Bennett, part of the go-between here, none of them left any direct accounts. Rather, Orson subsequently spoke for his wife, and Nancy's brother-in-law, who is estranged from the church and certainly estranged from Joseph Smith, George Robinson, spoke for it, and her 12-year-old brother spoke apparently for the first time 63 years after the event in 1905, in which he purported to describe his recollections of what took place. Now, and also, without belaboring the point, the disclosure comes about from Joseph's arch enemy, be a bit like going to Sharon Angle and asking her to describe Harry Reid's voting history, or worse, trusting a criminal defendant's unsupported alibi. So, were I a lawyer at that point in time, I can well imagine the excitement of a cross-examination that begins by asking about hearsay, five times removed. Asking about where is the minimal evidentiary standards to allow this to go to the jury. Inquiring about the bias of the witness. And noting that it comes from a person whose reputation for truth and veracity is virtually non-existent. And finally, talking about the prejudicial effect of it. The probative value, we say in the law, is outweighed by its prejudicial effect. And yet, as I say, every commentator uses that, quote, letter as though it stands for further evidence in support of plural marriage. I'm not here to talk about plural marriage today at all, but I thought it was interesting. Two nights ago, I spoke to Gordon Madsen. Gordon Madsen is the dean of Joseph Smith and the Law, 82 or 84 years old, I believe, and studied Joseph Smith and the Law his whole life when nobody else was interested in it. Gordon Madsen was prowling around in old courthouses and libraries trying to find out the original records. And I asked him specifically about this situation. I said, Gordon, what's your take on this? Bennett's letter that he prints from Joseph Smith to Nancy Rigdon. He said, his answer was, Ross, we'll just have to reserve judgment on that one. And I think, I don't know exactly how long we're going to have to reserve judgment. Maybe something will come to light subsequently, or maybe we'll all be waiting a long, long time to be able to see the videos of Earth Life, and maybe one of those will be the encounter between Joseph and Nancy. So I leave you with these thoughts that studying Joseph Smith is a fascinating exercise in any event, and it's, I think, doubly so as a lawyer studying Joseph Smith's legal affairs.